In this podcast, you may hear topics about suicide, mental health, other kinds of emotional crisis. If you find yourself being startled by this or currently experiencing something like is being talked about, especially suicide, I want to encourage you to reach out. The number 988 is a suicide crisis hotline, or you can reach out to myself also. But know that you are loved and take care.
Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't.
Welcome to Face of Appalachia, stories of personal values and faith in our region. So often in our region, people see us as a monocultural area where everyone's the same. But my experience has been really different, hearing stories from people that say, man, wow, this is in Eastern Kentucky, so I'm excited to journey with you. My name's Rob. I'm a priest and chaplain, and all throughout this time, we will meet some of my friends and guests. I want to give a special thanks to Kentucky Humanities, the National Endowment for Humanities, who's our grant sponsor. And today, I'm really excited. PhD, Dr. Summer Bingham Music is with us. And Summer, would you be willing to tell us a little bit about you?
Sure. I am a mom to a blended family of five. My kids range in age from 1 year to 17 years, and I often wonder how that happened. The only answer we have for that is poor life planning.
Or maybe God's blessing.
yes, that absolutely. So I'm a mom, I'm an associate professor of religious studies and currently the humanities division chair at the University of Pikeville. I'm from Elkhorn City, so about 45 minutes up the road. Like most people from this area, I am the daughter of a coal miner. My dad worked in the coal mines for years and then drove a coal truck for years after he got hurt. I'm a holler kid, I guess, that managed to make it all the way to PhD.
Yeah, so first generation college students.
Yes.
And big dreams of hopefully going out to some far off place like New York City, ended up going to college right here in Pikeville, Kentucky, and then you started your traveling. But you know, you talked about being a holler kid and kind of your traditional, you know, daughter of a coal miner, insert Loretta Lynn kind of background music and all this, the imagery. But talk about your spiritual journey, like growing up and now as an adult, but to start with kind of growing up, what was spiritually like for you?
So as a kid, we went to a few different churches, Church of Christ, Church of God, Baptist Church. I always say I grew up Baptist, though, because I think that's the one I have the most memory of. We went to church infrequently, but it was a family church. You know, the cousin was the pastor. I suspect a lot of people around here have a similar story. I had a lot of questions about God and for God when I was a kid that were never answered in a satisfactory way. So growing up, I remember being about 7, 8 years old, and I saw on the news a natural disaster had happened in India. I don't even remember the details now. But I had learned in church that week that if people weren't saved and they died, then they were going to go to hell. But I had also learned that God loved us more than we could possibly imagine. So I saw all these people that had died in this natural disaster, and I remember standing in front of the television and feeling really confused and asking, are all these people going to go to hell? Because that seems like the opposite of love to me. And I think people were really intimidated by those kinds of questions because they're really not sure how to answer them. And so the response I got from multiple places in my life was don't ask questions of God. You're not allowed to ask questions. It's wrong to question God. And so what ended up happening is as my life unfolded, it turns out I had a lot of really hard questions for God that I wasn't allowed to ask. I was sexually abused as a child for quite a few years. And the questions that I had just sort of ate me up. And I often say that it's almost as if the God question wouldn't stop pursuing me.
Hmm.
So I can remember as a child praying, begging God for abuse to end, night after night after night, begging God for some indication that God was there, and I never got that. And as I watched addiction take hold of the people around me for various reasons, and people I cared about doing terrible things and hurting people, I had a lot of really confusing questions. And so I say that my spiritual journey is this long, convoluted dance filled with doubt and faith and a lot of rage over the years. And I remember when I was a teenager, I was home alone, probably 14 or 15 years old. And I remember walking by a mirror and I just caught my reflection and something made me stop. And so I stood there for a minute and I realized when I was looking at myself that I didn't believe in God anymore. And that wrecked me. That was really hard. That took me from doubt to feeling like the bottom had dropped out of everything that I had known. But I wasn't sure what else to do with it because I had begged for proof, I had begged for help, and I had been taught time and time again in my, you know, childlike understanding of prayer that if you pray for help, God answers your prayers. And God had not answered my prayers for years. And no one in my world knew about the sexual abuse that was going on. I felt like I needed to protect the people around me, right? So I never said anything. And so help never came. And staring at my reflection, I realized that, you know, I had sort of put God to the test here to say, hey, I need you to show up. And God never showed up. And so when I came to this realization that I no longer believed in God, I just felt a profound sense of grief. And so the next stage of my spiritual journey...
Well, let me pause you right there for a second. So you talk about the, you know, the God question pursuing you, but then you, through all these just, you know, I want to kind of catch my breath from what you already just shared.
You kind of unload
all this really painful childhood, you know, teenage kind of stuff going on and, you know, addiction and abuse and even this notion of kind of having to bottle everything up, right? I mean, from your questions to your experiences to this kind of, you know, kind of what we hear about is keeping the family secrets or keeping the secrets of all the things around you, you know, you just can't say anything. But as you're doing that, it seems like your ideas or questions of God are kind of being pushed farther away. It's becoming less and less relevant. But yet, here you are, you have a PhD not in like computer science, or you don't have a PhD in astrophysics, you have a PhD in religious studies. As this question has pursued you, why not just at 14 or 15, when you had that moment, just own it? You know, like typical teenagers would, shave your hair, wear the black clothes and be like, I'm an atheist and everyone can just go screw themselves. Like, why did not be your pivot?
You know, I'm not sure. It's a question I've asked myself a lot, right along with why am I not like every other statistic? Because statistically, I should be addicted or in jail or dead, right? And the only answer I've been able to come to is it wouldn't stop pursuing me. Mm. It would have been so much easier to do that, mm-hmm. I think. And not that any of those paths are easy, but for some reason, I have always been unsettled by the God question. I have always wrestled with who God is and where God is in the midst of our pain. And even when I came to this realization that I no longer believed in God, I was still really angry about that. Mm. because I felt like I had been abandoned, I guess. And I felt as if, you know, I had been promised something that I could 100% rely on, that I obviously couldn't rely on. And so, yeah, just I couldn't let it go for some reason. So even after that, you know, I went through this kind of long rambling thing where I did the atheism thing for a while. Then I started undergraduate, and undergrad was a turning point for me. So kind of my late teenage years, I was really angry, but on the surface, I was very polite. No one would have ever known. Straight A student, you know, really holding it together, being the kind of the rock that held everybody together. And then when I came to undergrad here at Pottville College at the time, I took my first Bible class. It was Introduction to Old Testament with James Browning.
Did you take that because you wanted to? Was it forced on you? What was
it? It was part of the gen ed.
Yep. Okay.
And I was told, take it early if you can and get it out of the way.
Yep. Okay.
Everybody has to take them. These classes fill up quick. If you can get in it, then take it.
Okay.
So I did. And I remember sitting in class, and by the end of the semester, I realized that not only was it okay to ask questions about God, but that people had been doing it for a really long time. In fact, that's all of the Old Testament. Like, the entire Bible is full of people asking questions about God and to God. And that was so validating for me. And it sparked an interest. It kind of brought the God question back up for me. So I had all of this rage, and I had all of this unsettled stuff in my spirit, and then I was given permission to ask questions. Mm. It was really as simple as that, just permission to ask questions and to study other people asking similar questions. And when I realized that people had the same hard questions, I felt seen for the first time in a really long time. And I just became hungry for it. I took every religion class that I could. And the next one that I took was Intro to World Religions, because I was still really angry at Christianity.
Yeah.
I grew up being taught the kind of the primary cornerstone of Christianity is your sin nature, right? That you are sinful and God is here to save you, right? And that was problematic for me because I already felt ashamed and dirty and awful. I already hated myself because of the things that had happened. Didn't have the language for it at that age, but that's what was happening. And so when I went to church and I heard that you are a sinner and you don't deserve any of this, but God gives it to you because he loves you, all I heard was, yeah, you're right. You are dirty and awful and shameful.
Yeah.
And so that primary message of sin just pushed me further away from God to the point.
Did that feel like, I'm kind of putting words in your mouth there, but like, does that almost feel like another like level of abuse to kind of hear that in the church all the time?
Yeah, I think now as an adult, I would say that. At the time, I didn't have that kind of language, but yeah. Because it created yet another barrier to know God. Right, when I so desperately wanted to know God, being told that I was a sinner by nature, inherently sinful, just created one more barrier when I was already so far away from God's love and had been searching so desperately for it. So I took a world religions class after I had Old Testament. And that world religions class, I started to learn about Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism and all the religions of the world. And Buddhism really resonated with me at that time. And it's funny because in hindsight, I never would have came back to Christianity if it hadn't been for the Eastern religions.
Yeah.
And that probably throws people for a loop because they're not used to hearing
that. So let's make sure I'm hearing this clearly. You said your study of kind of a wide variety of religions, particularly the Eastern religions, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, all that kind of stuff. So those things actually brought you back to kind of a form of Christianity.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think it would not have worked for me for an evangelical Christian to come up to me and tell me about God's love. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have heard it. I was so angry at the church. I was so angry at Christianity that I hated what I have often called religious ease, right? That religious language that a lot of Christians around here use. I couldn't stand it. I could not have heard about God through Christianity at that phase of my life.
Yeah.
And so when I started learning about Eastern religions, Buddhism in particular, and I learned about the Four Noble Truths, that all life is suffering, that resonated with me so profoundly. Because you're right, all life is suffering. That's all I had known at this point. By the age of 20, I had been sexually abused on and off for a decade. I had watched addiction wreck multiple people in my lives and live under the rule of all the chaos that causes. I had been married and divorced by that point because I was searching for some safe place to land. I had slept in my car a bit, more than a few nights. And I had kept all of this secret, right? You know, people that loved me the most in my life had no idea that this was happening. And so when I learned that all life is suffering, that resonated with me on a profound level. And so I started trying to learn more and study more. I make it through undergrad. It's a long answer to your spiritual journey question. I made it through undergrad.
But just to highlight how much study was a really important step in your spiritual journey.
Yes.
Given freedom and in the classroom. Actually, the classroom for you was quite a sanctuary in some ways of where you could kind of encounter holy things.
Yes, the classroom became my church. Really.
Yeah. So you graduate and then tell us next.
So I got a job at Mountain Comprehensive Care Center. I was a case manager for a year. And while I was there, I met a couple of nuns that live at Mount Tabor Benedictine Community down in Martin. And one of the women I met was Laurie Sandblom. And I told Laurie my story. She was probably the first people that really kind of knew a lot of my story. And she helped me start to think about grad school. Because I'd always wanted, from the time of undergrad, I knew that I wanted to teach religion, right? And that gets complicated because I'm a woman, and I can't tell you that there were people who told me I wasn't allowed to do that because I was a woman.
Yeah.
But Laurie said, no, if you want to do that, let's do it. Let's make it happen. And I had always wanted to live in New York City because when I was 7 or 8 or 9 years old, I could not imagine anywhere more different from Appalachia than New York. But Laurie helped me find England, even further than New York City. So I applied to some grad schools. Laurie got me into Mount Tabor. The nuns at Mount Tabor took me in for about 5 months. I lived there. I did I participated in prayer life with them, which was transformational. There was no cell phone service, which was a beautiful thing. I bucked against for a while. And it was this really a safe space to pray, to settle in silence, to kind of discern what God had in store for me. With the caveat that I still didn't believe in God or wasn't really sure by this point. I wasn't really sure about God. So I would say I'm inching more at this point in my life towards agnosticism, living at a monastery as an agnostic.
But the monastery was safe.
Yeah.
It provided you it's better than your car. It's better than a broken marriage. It's like, okay, so you're safe, even though you're doing the religious cycle, but at least like you could, it's kind of like an exercise, academic exercise. Here you are participating in it, right? And so with the chance of going off to grad school and Laurie is pushing you and inspiring you and trying to make space for you. And
yeah, all the women at Mount Tabor, really. A lot of them had traveled internationally. Kathy DeVio would sit and talk to me at dinner every evening about when she used to bike around Paris. And so I started to dream that maybe this was possible. Laurie helped me with my visa. And she actually moved to England with me for 2 weeks to get me settled. And I often say, like, if it hadn't been for that, I don't think I ever would have gone.
Yeah.
So here I am, this holler kid that's never left Kentucky, really. Hopping on a plane and flying to London, right? And so I moved to Bristol, England for a year. And that, my life trajectory changed completely because of that. Laurie got me settled in. I was living in an international co-ed dorm. I had my own room and I shared a flat with five other people from my best friend Elaine from Malaysia, my other best friend Omar from Mexico, and then three Chinese flatmates. And I was in a cohort of religious studies students that were small. But that was beautiful in and of itself, right? So we got to know our professors. I met my friend Nora, who is Irish, and she studies shamanism. And so for a year, I just got some space. I stood on my own. I really moved from a child to an adult. Like England grew me up. I became much more independent, much more sure of myself. I came back a different person than when I left. And while I was there, I had the chance to travel, to go to Germany, to go to Spain, to go to Wales, Ireland a few times. I got to meet people from all over the world who believed all sorts of different things. I got to study with some of the leading names in Buddhist studies. And I got to explore feminist theology for the first time, which is something I swore I was never going to do.
Yeah.
and I had a professor in Bristol, Carolyn Musig, who encouraged me to look at Marguerite Perret's Mirror of Simple Souls for her class. And so I wrote this paper on this mystic and started to think maybe there's a little more space to think about Christianity. Mm. Because the only Christianity I had known was Appalachian Christianity, right? Small church Christianity here in the mountains. And one of the freshman student events that they had at Bristol was this like mixer where they provided food, and it was at this big church close to where our classes were. And I sat down with my friend Anju, who's from Korea, and the pastor of this church walks up to us and invites us to church, and I don't really know what to say. And Anju said, "No thank you, I'm not Christian." And he went, "Okay, do you want some food?" And that, I know that sounds so simple, but that was huge. Like, I'd never seen that happen before. For somebody to just say, "No thanks, I'm not Christian," and still be accepted, and still be offered a plate of food.
Yeah.
Not try to convert them, not try to, you know, tell them how wrong they are, but to just create space for a different belief. And that openness made me go back to that church.
Wow.
Because it just created some space to think, right? So it was a really vast, multicultural, international experience at Bristol. So I was there for a year.
Well, so you're there for a year, and this feels like, oh my gosh, this is everything you've ever hoped for.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like different than the holler. It's way far away from all the chaos. Like, your friends have supported you now. Like, you're in the kind of the buffet or Disney world of just diversity and difference, and you're just so excited, and things, it seemed like you're just crushing it, right? Like, you're being your best self.
Yeah.
And then you come back to Eastern Kentucky.
it's a move that I still question sometimes. You can take the girl out of Appalachia, but you can't take the Appalachia out of, because that's too stereotypical.
I mean, it's your journey.
even at Bristol, and I got in therapy for the first time, really, and I started to work through some things. I miss the mountains. You know, I found myself at 3 a.m. Listening to Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton.
Second Loretta Lynn reference today.
It is. and I miss my family.
The family that was,
I know.
Keep going. Sorry, this is like I'm interested. Okay, so you missed it, so you then decide you want to come back home, and
yeah. Well, so part of this is I got to do an in-depth study of Buddhism while I was at Bristol, and one of the things we spent a lot of time on was causation. We looked a lot at dependent co-arising, or paticca samuppada, this teaching that all things give rise to everything else, that nothing exists independently. And as I was going through therapy while I was doing this, and I started to move beyond rage for the people who had caused me harm and started to think, what's their story?
What a shift.
What happened to them?
Yeah, what a shift.
Wow. That caused this. And so I was piqued by curiosity, and these relationships are very complicated, right? Because, you know, you still care about people, right?
Yeah.
And so I wondered, what has been their pain? Hmm. I know what my pain is. What's been their pain? And so part of me also, I had that kind of realization, and then part of me also thought about the other kids in the holler who were experiencing this, who had these God questions that they weren't allowed to ask, and what a gift it would be to give them the insight that I'd had.
Hmm.
What a gift it would be to be able to take this wisdom back to Appalachia and say, you know, there's space for you. If you think there's no space for you, I'm telling you that we can create it.
Yeah.
And so I felt this calling to come back to the mountains. And I knew at that point in my life, I wasn't sure how it was going to manifest yet, but I knew somewhere along my journey that theology and psychology were going to mix. I just didn't know how. So here I am kind of in the middle of a healing journey. And really trying to figure out what my next steps were. And it felt like I was supposed to bring this back home. So I did. And then I started a second master's. It was supposed to be a PhD, but the funding thing didn't work out. So it ended up being a master's of philosophy. And I found my way through that sort of back to Christianity.
So again, classroom, study, even though it didn't work out, because you're going to go for your PhD, you're going off again, and something you didn't mention is that you kind of have somewhat of a mystical experience in that study when you go to an island. So you're from a remote rural place that's complicated, and you're going to escape those types of things, right? And you did when you went to England, and then in this MPhil or Master's of Philosophy degree, what did you encounter?
So, I came back to teach here at UPike, and Tom Hess, who was the dean at the time, said, "Hey, do you want to teach an international trip?" And I was like, "Will you give me a job?" So I did an international trip with students. And my friend Nora, who I mentioned before, she was Irish and shaman. She said to me, "Summer, I found this island. It's called Skellig Michael."
Skellig Michael, yeah, okay.
Skellig Michael. And she said, you've got to go there. It will change your life." And so when I planned this international trip with students, we were going to go to England and Ireland. I said, "Okay, let's go to Skellig Michael." So we did, and it's kind of miraculous that we actually made it to the island, because most people don't. It's really difficult to dock on the island, and so it's sort of hit or miss, even when you book your ticket, whether or not the boat's actually going to be able to take you there.
Yeah.
But we made it. It's really kind of a one-in-a-lifetime thing. There have been other times I've tried to go and haven't been able, so it's miraculous that it happened. So we hop on this boat, we fly the students to Ireland, we get to the Ring of Kerry, we hop on this boat, the students are hanging off the side of the boat seasick.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, this island that looks like it's something straight out of Jurassic Park rises out of the fog. And I remember thinking, "God, please don't let me forget how I feel right now.
Mm.
Like, don't let me forget this experience." And we dock and we climb up, and it's 700 and some steps to the top. 700 rickety
Yeah.
Made out of stone steps, wider in places and narrow at others. People have fallen off of the island and died. So you got to be careful when you're walking. The steps tend to get slick from the sea spray. But there's no garbage cans. There's no bathrooms. It's really remote.
Just a rock.
Just a rock. And these monks in the 7th century made these steps to the top of the island. And at the top of it, they've built these huts, and they prayed, and they lived there on this island. And when I reached the top of it, and it's funny because when you get to kind of the last set of steps, you're really kind of crawling. Mm-hmm. They have this chain there to kind of help you get up so you don't fall. But it's really kind of a hands and knees emerging to the top of this island situation. And it's, I don't have words. I still to this day don't have words to describe what that experience is like. You can look at the pictures. You can watch Star Wars because it's in episode 7 where Luke is living, right? but there's nothing like being on top of that island.
It was like a force.
It was the force.
Okay.
And I think that in that moment, I said, I have to study this. I have to know more. Again, going back to the classroom, right?
Yeah.
Like, scholarship has really been my way of encountering God. And so I had to know more about this island. And what I discovered through my MPhil research was that these monks in the 7th century built a retaining wall, which is nuts because they had to hang off the side of the mountain and move this heavy rock. It's just mind-blowing. I looked at the Hermitage, which you're not allowed to go to when you go as a tourist. It's kind of set up on the South Peak. And I studied the archaeology. I printed off the archaeological reports and put them in a big giant binder. And you know, the whole time I was studying, I flipped through the archaeology. I can remember sitting at James Browning's house one night, like 11 o'clock at night, with maps on his kitchen table, trying to learn about the way Irish monks encountered God through their landscape. And the thesis of my MPhil research was that in this journey, this peregrination, that the monks would move closer and closer to God through their landscape. So almost all of the monastic sites in Ireland have kind of an outer rim, like a wall, and then there's internally you've got the places where the monks lived, and then at the center is the what we would call the sanctuary of the church,
yeah.
Right, where they prayed and stuff. And so for Skellig, that was the same times 10 because you had the mainland, the ocean, where you're moving across this dangerous sea of chaos to finally dock. You climb up this mountain, right, this rock on this island, and then you have the outer wall, the hermitage, the living quarters, and then the church, the sanctuary. And so I could physically see that movement towards the center, towards God.
Mm.
And part of this process was called white martyrdom. So red martyrdom being you die for Christ, white martyrdom is sort of a lesser death where you abandon kind of the world and become this monk set apart from society for God.
Wow. So from 14, looking in the mirror and said, I don't believe any of this anymore, to maps on the table of a former professor that you're studying archaeology and trying to figure out how 7th century monks who you've never met get closer to God. You return then back to home again, begin your journey, and the inner journey for you is continuing,
mm-hmm.
right? So just like the monks were using their landscape, really for you the landscape was your own body and soul, and you're moving on the inside, and you're doing some real work, right? And you take on a different study that seems to have a bigger impact on you also. You really kind of work on trauma. And what has that next step been for you? I mean, it's one thing to have an island arise out of the fog and just be so taken by it. But it's really hard when you're climbing those steps and a rock jams you on the side or you try to slip a little bit. And so your own white martyrdom was kind of going on the inside. Tell us about your study of trauma and particularly, I mean, you dove into a really, just like Skelly Michael's super remote, you went into kind of the remote section of the trauma version and you looked at incest. Mm-hmm. And that question, the God question, that's the next step for you. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so when I started my PhD, so I finished my MPhil, got to know Celtic Christianity and Celtic theology a bit, which just sparked, it brought me back to God.
Yeah.
And then I started my PhD. I went to a PhD program where I could receive a scholarship. So that was really helpful. And it was originally at St. Thomas University. We ended up, the program transferred, and we ended up finishing at Palm Beach Atlantic University. But when I went down for my first intensive weekend, we had intensives at the beginning and end of every semester. Mm-hmm. When I went down there for the first one, I had every intention of continuing my research on Skellig. I interviewed for the program with that in mind, like that's what I told the program director I was going to study. They were all about it. And we got there, and Dr. Fraley put us all in a room and had us kind of go around. And, you know, we named the virtues that we wanted to work on. We really got to know each other that weekend. We were all exhausted. We were all nervous.
Yeah.
And then kind of at the end of the weekend, he put us in a big giant circle and said, just kind of say a few words about why you're here. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the last people to go, and I surprised even myself that when it came my turn, instead of talking about Skellig, I opened my mouth and rape was what came out. Trauma and rape.
That's
just a hard shift.
Yeah. You really caught me off guard there.
Hard shift, yeah. But that's... That even the shocking nature of that,
yeah,
I think is,
absolutely,
is what took even me, mm-hmm, right? Because here I've been doing this therapy, I've been doing the things, right? But really, my academic life had been, you know, very book oriented, and I started to talk about trauma, and here I am in a room full of, you know, 18 people that I barely know. And I say, I was sexually abused as a child, and I want to study trauma theology. I want to know where God was in this. And that started a whole sea of new research for me.
Yeah.
And that program and the cohort from that program, I keep saying things changed my life, but there's just so many pivotal moments.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, so all of my coursework then became about learning more about trauma theology. I started looking still at books and articles, but I started learning a little more about embodied theology. Excuse me.
So embodied theology, this notion of, I mean, I guess it sounds like kind of the impact of your body and how you experience things.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what I learned as I studied trauma is that trauma does not live in the brain. It lives in the body. And we know from Bessel van der Kolk's work, The Body Keeps the Score, which a lot of people...
Yeah, kind of a
know.
Classic.
Kind of a classic, yeah. Now. Is that trauma, even if our conscious mind forgets it, our body still holds on to those memories. And that was really what I was experiencing. So I struggled through all of this with panic attacks. Took me years to figure out that that's what it was, with nightmares and flashbacks. And what really I can now say was probably complex PTSD. And I was learning more and more about how my body had held on to the things that had happened to me. That there were weird symptoms that I had that once I started to scratch the surface, realized there's a memory there that's trying to be made known, that needs a voice, that needs to be worked through. And so I found yoga at that point, because yoga, I'd learned through all the research, is like the thing that is supposed to help you. So I said, okay, let's do some yoga. And I tried to do it when I was in Bristol, and I did a few yoga classes, and every single time I did it, I got deathly ill. Like vomiting, exhausted for days, couldn't do it.
Okay, so I want to make sure I'm understanding. You know, so you just, like, you know, everyone says, hey, go to yoga, put on some yoga pants and get the cool drink and, like, go to the thing. So you try yoga, but actually it's not this serene, like, now I'm all flexible, I'm going to levitate. I mean, you're, like, puking your brains out.
Awful.
You're super sick.
Yeah.
So back then, did you just kind of think, wow, I'm just, like, kind of suck at yoga, or, like...
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I thought. I was like, oh, well, like, I thought this was supposed to be great, but it turns out I really hate this.
Yeah, yoga sucks.
Yes, exactly. Like, this is making me sick for some reason. I don't know why. So I just, like, abandoned it.
Okay.
But when I came back to it at my doctorate work and I started doing it, I still got sick. But now I had the resources to know why. Mm. And I think that it was that there was all this trauma trapped in my body that had never been voiced. And so I leaned into it. Whereas I wasn't in the space to lean into that when I lived in Bristol. I wasn't that far along on my healing journey yet. Now I could lean into it. And so I did it little by little.
So when you're doing this, right? So yoga is just kind of like a microcosm of kind of this greater thing. But did you ever have any moments when you're studying, or you're kind of really, maybe for the most intense time of your life, really giving yourself to think about all that's going on, did you ever have a moment where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm really not crazy when I felt all these things before. Now I actually know what in the world was happening.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, for the first time, I really realized almost exactly that I had felt crazy for so long.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think I ever voiced it all that much. Mm-hmm. I was always very well put together, straight A student, did what I was supposed to do in class.
Checked all the boxes.
Yeah. But internally, I was falling apart and I felt insane. And I mean, I would have these panic episodes where I could just feel hands crawling all over my body. Mm. And I thought I was nuts.
Sure, yeah.
But then when I got a little further along and I started to learn more about trauma, I realized what that was. That was a flashback. And once I could put language to it, I started to learn more about the brain. I got really interested in neurotheology, about the impact that God has and spiritual practice has on your brain. I started to learn about what trauma does to the brain and body. And I learned a little bit about the science behind it all. And once I had that language, it didn't feel so overwhelming anymore. Because I learned what was happening, that my amygdala is always in overdrive, and why it's been in overdrive for so long, and why when I get really stressed, I throw up. But I also learned that what the healing process looks like on the brain, and I learned what the healing process looks like in the body, and that as much as our trauma is written onto our body, so is our healing. So is our successes. And the successes of my grandmother and my great-grandmother and my great-great-great-grandmother, right? All that's written in our DNA, just as much as the generational trauma. And so I started to learn all of this, and it was really empowering. And so my research and my PhD took me in this direction. And you mentioned incest a little while ago. I was really resistant to studying incest.
Yeah.
Because it's taboo.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is like the ultimate taboo, right?
Yeah, nobody wants to talk about it.
I mean, you go walk into a party and you're like, hey, incest. Yeah. Everyone's like, I'm leaving right now.
Let me tell you, nothing kills a conversation faster than when somebody asked me when I was studying my PhD.
Like, can we just go back and talk about the island instead?
Yeah. But people are fans of, you know, they're supporters of helping children who've been sexually abused. Nobody is against that.
Yeah.
But the second you say incest, people start to go, ooh, right? They recoil.
Yes.
And it's almost subconscious. But most juvenile victims of sexual abuse, 80-some percent of them are victims of incest.
So 80-some percent of victims, kids who are victims of sexual abuse, it's incest.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's stunning.
Yeah.
Stunning. Yep. I mean, that kind of feels like one of those, you know, islands that come out of the fog. You're like, holy smokes. I mean, it happens all around us. And like, so what's like the statistics on, like, who, you know, is it just the creepy guy in the candy van? Or like, who's the perpetrator oftentimes?
We want it to be the creepy guy in the candy van.
Yeah,
because then we can protect and control that. But more often than not, it's somebody in the home, an uncle, a father, a stepfather, a brother, right?
Well, that's right. It's not stranger danger. It's in the home.
It's in the home. Yeah.
So as you're studying this and you are really doing just like really intense, hard work. I mean, you've gone from maps on tables to like trying to figure out why your heart rate's going up, why you're having flashbacks, all this kind of stuff. And you've connected with yoga. And I know that so often in kind of more rural places, yoga would be one of those things where it's like, that's like a tool of the, you can't do that. It's another taboo, right? Incest is taboo, yoga's taboo, and you keep leaning into these taboo places. So when you were, like, I know you kind of told us a little bit about how those went together, but like yoga as a spiritual practice for you?
Yeah, I think so. Not at first.
Okay.
But it certainly evolved that way. And I've always kind of been leaning into the taboos, right? Even at 9 years old when I'm asking why these people
really,
need help. I think that is where our wisdom is found, is in those places where we're told we're not supposed to ask questions.
Wisdom is said again?
Our wisdom can be found in those places where we're not supposed to ask questions.
That's really deep. I appreciate that, yeah.
So, yoga as a spiritual practice. So first for me, it was a way to manage anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, I started doing it, I got sick, then I picked it up again, and I was still getting sick, but now I knew why, and so I sort of eased into it. Mm-hmm. And right around this time that I was working on my PhD, I got married, I had 3 stepkids, and then I eventually had 2 kids of my own, and so my life went from being very, very quiet to very, very loud almost overnight.
5 kids would be pretty intense.
Yeah. So yoga became one of the only quiet places in my life. And my whole life, I had really valued silence. You know, most people, when they're alone, they flip on the radio or they turn on music or a podcast
or something.
Of course, yeah. I was never that person. When alone, I would prefer to be in silence. And because there's a lot going on in my head. You know, I can't think if it's loud, right? Mm. So yoga became one of the only silent places. And so it became a way to tune into my body. It became a prayer with my body. For so long.
I just want to make sure I highlight that. So like to become in tune with your body, the path was silence, and being in tune with your body actually became a prayer.
Yes. Yeah, so for so long, I had been trapped in my body and frozen, literally, in the middle of traumatic experiences. I would just freeze. And now, as an adult in my 30s by this point, I was starting to move my body, to connect with my body in a way that I never had before. So yoga became an embodied prayer that I would do a sun salutation and just be mindful in that moment. And that mindfulness became a prayer. That mindfulness, that silence became a way for me to invite God into this space to heal and help me work out these tendrils of trauma that were still wrapped around me.
Hmm. Wow, I'm just really moved by the idea that you know, just becoming more in touch with your own body really becomes kind of your spiritual practice, but also like a huge part of your spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one of the things about particularly mountain Christianity at times is there's kind of this, you know, not straight out, not over, but kind of under the surface of like, yeah, kind of, it gets better when you get away from your body, mm-hmm. right? When you die and you're a soul and you get away from your body, or at least your body's made new, because this body is like holding you back and it's right, you hit all this kind of notion. But for you, really, it was like, no, I got to get more in touch with this body.
Yeah, and I think that the church had taught me all those things. Mm-hmm. And I started to think about, well, in church, I just sit here all stiff. The most movement we have is standing up or sitting down, right? Mm-hmm. Or passing the peace. And I was never comfortable being one of those people that would raise their hands and praise. Even though I felt like I wanted to, I just couldn't.
Yeah.
And so I started to ask, well, what's the difference in my relationship with God if I pray with my head bowed versus if I pray with my face up to the sky and my arms open? How does that feel different? Mm. How does that change the way that I'm encountering God?
And you're talking about, like, so kind of traditional body practices in like a classic Christian worship service, as opposed to like Christian or practices, bodied practices in like yoga practice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So in church, there wasn't much movement, right? But yeah. I started to think about, well, based on how I move my body, how does that change the way I encounter God?
Yeah.
And that rolled into yoga.
Sure. Yeah. Right? So yoga's helping you. And so then with this yoga being so helpful, I feel like I cut you off earlier. And I know we're bouncing around, but I really felt like I cut you off because you were kind of going there a little bit with incest and how it's a taboo and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, did you have anything else you wanted to say about that before we wrap up here? I wanted to make sure I don't let you cut you off on that.
Sure. So incest is this taboo. People don't want to talk about it. But yet the statistics show us that it's the most prevalent form of child sexual abuse. And the reason I wanted to lean into that is to shine light on it, because I think that the only way to rid people of shame is to shine a light on it. And if no one is talking about it, if no one is illuminating it, then how can we possibly recover from it? So my PhD research looked specifically at that. So the first half of my dissertation looked at the context of incest. And I really identified the core wound of incest to be a spiritual wound. In my life, this experience taught me that I am less than. It taught me that I am not made in God's image, that I am this shameful, awful, dirty thing. And that was really the deepest wound. And so I went straight to what I thought was the heart of the problem, straight to the heart of the wound. And I did a whole chapter in the first half on what it means to be made in God's image. And, you know, looked at the theology behind it historically. And then the second half of my dissertation looks at Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Resurrection Sunday. Because I wanted to encounter Jesus myself. My whole life, people had told me who Jesus was. People had told me who God was. They had given me this theology that felt cookie cutter, and none of it resonated with me.
Sure.
And so in my dissertation, I needed to have a conversation with God. And that's what the second half of my dissertation is, really, is looking at this experience through the experience of Jesus. And so I make the argument that Jesus was sexually abused in my dissertation.
I'm sure that's real popular, about as popular as incest, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So Jesus was sexually abused. I somehow maybe missed that. Is that like in the 25th chapter of John or something?
Well, think about it. Okay. If you were to take somebody right now onto the streets of Pikeville and strip them naked and beat them, would we not call that sexual abuse?
Yeah, I mean, stripping someone naked, we don't really know what happened behind the closed doors with the Roman guards, right?
And we do know from our study on Roman crucifixion that sexual threat was implicit. Like, it was a thing that the Romans used. We know that. And we don't know what happened behind the closed doors. And while I can't say, you know, definitively, if that's what happened, I can say that Jesus was publicly humiliated. He was stripped naked. There was an implicit threat of sexual violence. And that would be traumatic for anyone.
Yeah. So that little, like, you know, and I know some people may be offended by my terms here, but that kind of the classic Christian loincloth on Jesus that kind of sanitizes the good, you know, the Easter plays and or our art. Because rarely do you walk into a church and Jesus is on the cross. Yeah, Jesus isn't naked, right? He's kind of gently covered up. But what you're saying is that's not it.
No, no. And we're so uncomfortable with it that we do put the loincloth on it. We put the loincloth on all the art and all the statues because it's just too difficult for our sensibilities to imagine Jesus sexually humiliated on a cross.
Yeah, so let's go back real quick to that, what you just said. You know, this loincloth on Jesus, because we just can't, like, go there, right? It's just, like, too much. And maybe, you know, the seven-year-old we take into church, we don't want those questions too, right? So I'm taking, you know, when you start raising these questions at 7, 8, 9 years old or whatever, and people kind of say, you know, put that in a bottle, don't raise those questions. And then you have all this difficulty that happens in your life, and you just can't speak about it. Maybe no one even told you, you just learned keep things secret, right? But as now like a scholar and as a mid-30s adult, now you're saying the quiet things out loud.
Mm-hmm.
As we close, how did that happen? How did you move from a person who keeps secrets and bottles things up to maybe start saying the quiet things out loud?
You're
not fully there yet. I mean, I don't know, but I'm just hearing that in your journey.
I feel like when I wrote my dissertation, and it's funny because we started this conversation and I told you how much I couldn't stand the religious ease kind of language.
Here
I am, full circle. But when I wrote my dissertation, I know I wrote it. I sat at the computer and typed it all out. But I really feel like God was leading me in that.
Mm.
I don't feel like that never would have happened if it was just Summer running that, right? I feel like God was helping me make this story known to help heal people. And so now I'm saying these things out loud. And I went to a church service. A woman in my cohort, Reverend Dr. Karen Reed, her and her husband, Dr. Anthony Reed, had...
Reverend Dr. Karen Reed.
Reverend Dr. Karen Reed.
Dr. Reed. Okay, go ahead.
So I went to a church service at her AME church in Miami, the Purple Church, and it was the weekend of my doctorate graduation, and I love Karen and Anthony, so I was just like, hey, let's go to this church. And I'd had a really powerful weekend of presenting my research to overwhelming positive feedback. Yeah. And then I go to this church, and Anthony's sermon and Karen's sermon was, God is in your mouth, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That you are speaking what God is telling you to speak, right? That you have a message, you've got a voice. And a big piece of our doctoral experience was Dr. Fraley telling us, find your voice.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I'm at now, is words matter. And anytime we shroud something in silence, it just causes more harm. But naming things doesn't have to be mean. It doesn't have to hurt people who've hurt you. Right? I think when you speak love and grace and mercy and understanding into situations, it creates this beautiful avenue for healing. And that's where I'm at right now, is trying to figure out how to use the gift of this voice in the way that God wants me to.
Hmm. So that feels like an ongoing
yes
kind of journey. Yeah, right. So I know you're working on a book, so we can't advertised that yet, but it's coming. And you know, people want to connect with you. They can just kind of look on the University of Pikeville's website and search you out. You're not too hard to find. But you know, as we wrap up, if anyone, well, I shouldn't say this, but you know, even if two people listen to our podcast, or let's just say four people listen, statistically, one of four is going to have experience with sexual abuse.
Yes.
What would you say? I'm going to give you a chance to open up your mouth here. What would you say to that person who maybe something has been stirred inside of them to kind of look at their own journey and maybe have to face that abuse? What would you say to them?
I'll say it gets better. It might get worse before it gets better, but it will get better. To trust yourself and trust your voice and find your safe space. And you might have to seek it out. I have been blessed and lucky in my life to have groups of people around me that have cultivated safe space at every part of my journey. And if you don't have that safe space, reach out to me. I'm happy to be that safe space for you. Mm.
Well, Dr. Summer Bingham Music, I am really thankful for the time to be able to be with you and for you to share and what feels like just a really an exciting ongoing journey.
Jesus, please
continue to grow and help others do that. So I'm glad that you've returned home and are giving back. So thanks for being a guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I simply don't know.